Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the Triangle North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the North Carolina State Extension Gardener e-newsletter, Dave's Garden e-newsletter, the Triangle Gardener magazine, and maybe from Tips for the Lazy Gardener by Linda Tilton. We'll start with the North Carolina State Extension Gardener. Lawns. Practice observation in the lawn this summer. Summertime is a great time to enjoy the sunshine, but hot and humid weather is stressful for many plants, including your lawn. Observe your lawn this summer and take steps to improve the health of your grass. In any lawn, avoid mowing when the grass is wet. Cutting while it's wet and humid can encourage disease in your lawn. Wait until the grass has dried. When mowing your lawn, change the direction in which you mow each time to keep the grass growing upright. If weather's been dry for a long period, watch the lawn as you walk through it. When your footprints remain in the grass for an extended period after you walk across it, it means your lawn is under water stress. Water early in the morning to allow the grass time to absorb water before the heat of the day. If you're seeing a heavy infestation of summer weeds, consider renovating your lawn at the appropriate time of year. Encouraging healthy turf is the best way to fight weeds. Cool season lawns should be renovated in fall, but wait until late spring to renovate a warm season lawn. Take a soil test to determine the appropriate fertilizer for your yard and whether you need to adjust the pH of your soil. If you grow a cool season lawn, such as tall fescue, the grass will slow its growth and may go dormant during the heat of summer. Do not fertilize during this time of year. Instead, start planning your fall maintenance or renovations. Consult the North Carolina State Turf Files website for a list of top performing tall fescue cultivars in North Carolina and try to find a seed mix that contains those varieties. And, of course, be sure to take some time to enjoy your lawn while the sun is shining. And food production. Grow summer microgreens. What's the difference between sprouts and microgreens? Sprouts are grown for their seed leaves, seeds, and roots, and usually indoors without soil. Microgreens, on the other hand, can be grown outdoors or indoors with light and on a thin layer of soil media or organic fabric. They are harvested when the seed leaves and sometimes the first true leaves have developed and take 7 to 14 days from seed to plate. Microgreens are an excellent diet enhancer. They grow fast, come in a variety of textures and culinary uses, and their nutritional content can be 4 to 40 times the amount in their full-grown counterparts. To grow microgreens, you need a clean, black plastic tray, soilless potting mix labeled for vegetables without water-holding crystals, and seeds for planting. The tray must have drainage holes. Put a screen of some kind over the growing microgreens to protect them from squirrels and birds. Make sure you purchase seeds that are labeled free of pesticides and for human consumption. Sunflower greens are excellent in hot weather, while pea shoots or coal crops grow best when it's cool. Put 1 inch to 1.5 inches of potting soil in the tray and scatter the seeds thickly over the soil. Large seeds will almost touch, while smaller seeds might be at least 10 to 12 seeds per square inch. Cover lightly, if at all, with a fine layer of potting mix and water gently. Keep the growing mix moist but not soggy. Once sprouted, tiny plants need at least 4 hours of sun a day or a grow light to get their full green color. During summer months, limit sun exposure to the morning hours. After 7 to 14 days, Use scissors or a sharp knife to cut the microgreen seedlings off just above the soil line, rinse, and enjoy in all your recipes. Dump the soil in the garden, wash and sanitize the tray, fill with new soil, and prepare for your next batch. And now, and that one particular article was written by Gina Myers. Our next one, Smart Gardening, Squash Bug Management by Minda Daughtry. Squash bugs are sometimes mistaken for stink bugs. While they do look similar and also give off a foul odor when crushed or disturbed, squash bugs eat only plants of the cucurbit family, preferring squash and pumpkin. Initial symptoms you might notice include small yellow specks on the leaves that turn brown. In large numbers, leaves can wilt and turn yellow, reducing plant growth and fruit yield. If you have a small plant and the damage has progressed to the wilting stage, it may not recover. Large plants can handle more pressure than small ones and may survive despite many affected leaves. Here are 7 simple tips you can use to manage squash bugs in your garden. 1. Resistance to squash bugs varies among cucurbit crops, with pumpkin among the most susceptible. Look for resistant varieties or rotate out of susceptible crops. 2. Scouting for squash bugs is the most effective way to manage the problem. As leaves begin to wilt, check for squash bugs and eggs underneath the leaves. It is easier to kill eggs and young squash bugs. 3. Individually collect and kill the squash bugs and their eggs and destroy them if you find only a small number. 4. Place a board or shingles around the plant. The squash bugs will gather under the boards at night for shelter. Using this method, a large number of squash bugs can be killed every morning until the problem is under control. 5. Use an insecticide along with the above methods to ensure a thorough result. Follow label directions carefully, especially to avoid harming pollinators during flowering. 6. Keep vines covered until blossoming begins, since there is only one generation of squash bugs per year. And 7. Dispose of all plant debris over the winter months. You can either burn or compost it. Now from Dave's Garden, The Lictrum for Garden Interest by Donna Mack. The lictrums are some of the most intriguing plants available to gardeners. These plants are grown all over the world, so there is a variety undoubtedly suited to your garden. The lictrum is available in colors ranging from white to pink to yellow to violet. Heights range from 2 feet to 8 feet. Where to grow the lictrum? I have read they require a moist environment in shade, but I have grown them in anything from mostly sun to complete shade. They can be used in anything from a wild to a cultivated dark garden. They can be back-of-the-border plants or amazing specimens for the front of the bed. One of their great features is their beauty when out of bloom and the denseness of the panicles when they are in bloom. They are incredibly flexible. They are easy care plants. They do like a humus-rich soil, although I find some varieties can handle substantial neglect. Taller ones, like the Lictrum Splendid, can need staking. I've never needed to stake the Lictrum Rochebrunium, which is one of the tallest. Most meadow rues are late to emerge, generally in mid to late spring. At least some of them, like Rochebrunianum, reseed. I originally purchased 8 and ended up with 20 after a few years. They feature a basal clump of fine textured foliage that can sometimes be mistaken for columbine foliage. If you order the lictrum, as I have, you sometimes discover that the plants are columbines. The lichtrum, Rochebrunianum, with its beautiful purple flowers with yellow stamens, originated in Japan. It is hardy in zones 4 to 7, grows 4 to 6 feet with a spread of 2 to 3 feet, blooms from July to September. It can take full sun to part shade. It's fabulous because the stems look frosted. Once you buy a few, you should always have them because it gently reseeds, but the stems are so slender it does not interfere with other plants. It is unusual even among the lichtrum because the stems appear to be covered with transparent frost. The beautiful flowers are lavender purple. It is widely available at a reasonable price. The lichtrums have a variety of forms and colors. The lichtrum aquilegifolium is a lovely pink flowering plant, verging toward violet, and also available. It typically grows in zones 5 through 8, but is said to be intolerant of sun in the southern areas of the country. Height and spread are 2 to 3 feet and can handle full sun to part shade in most parts of the country. The lichtrum aquilegifolium sparkler is one of my favorites. It is a Terra Nova nursery introduction and a very tough plant. I acquired two in 2006, moved one of them to my new yard in 2012. It's still flourishing, and interestingly enough, it was in full sun and is now in mostly shade. The biggest difference is that it grows a foot taller. Unfortunately, it seems to be out of commerce, but there are other white ones with similar beauty. The lichtrums were originally wildflowers, and our own Dave's Garden Melody commented, "I do not cultivate this plant. It grows wild in my area. This is a tall plant with cream to white plumes of small flowers at the top, found in swamps, along stream banks and damp meadows from Ontario east to Newfoundland, south to Georgia, west to Mississippi, north into Illinois, and into Michigan. The plants can get quite tall, over 6 feet in some instances, and the flower plumes are popular with bees and butterflies. For fans of yellow, the Thalictrum flavum SSP glaucum, hardy in zones 5 to 8, are 2 feet tall and 2 feet wide. Otherwise, it enjoys the same sun-to-shade conditions of others. Another wonderful thalictrum is black stockings, hardy from zones 4 to 9, gets its name from its nearly black stems, topped with beautiful, fluffy, pink to lavender flowers that are some of the largest in the plant family. It blooms for weeks, and from experience requires no care other than deadheading and then cutting to the ground at the end of the season. I would encourage you not to waste this plant at the back of the border as I did originally. You want to put this plant where it can be seen. The lichtrum splendid is the hot new kid on the block. It was actually discovered as a garden seedling and is a cross between the lichtrum elegans and Thalictrum delavea. What fabulous parents! This plant is anything from 5 to 9 feet and possesses 2-foot-wide reddish stalks, carrying ferny foliage, and looking like a star, carrying copious lavender-pink flowers. The floral selection is massive but light, and the flowers cover the top 3 feet of the plant. It blooms over a long period, from June to September in the middle zones, and amazingly, is hardy to zone 3. It comes in white, which is even newer. Then, there is the tiny, delicate Thalictrum minus. The name references the delicacy of the flowers, because it is, in fact, 3 feet tall and wide. It has very small, nodding flowers in an unusual shade of yellowish plum brown. If you are a fan of the maidenhair fern, this is the Thalictrum for you. I hope you will try some of these wonderful plants. I have gotten much pleasure from them over the years. And then some information on Love in a Mist, Nigella damascena. This native of southern Europe has been popular with gardeners for hundreds of years. Elizabethan cottage gardens often sported these lacy and delicate blossoms. While they may look frail, Nigella damascena is a tough little annual that happily reseeds and reliably returns each year. Some gardeners find that they may reseed with too much enthusiasm and grumble about unwanted seedlings, but the cheery flowers in shades of blue, white, and lavender seem to be at home wherever they sprout. If you want to prevent surprise seedlings, simply deadhead the flowers as they fade. Love in a Mist likes sunny, well-drained conditions and moderately fertile soil. They grow to 12 to 18 inches and form loose clumps. The unique seed pods are as attractive as the blossoms, but they tend to explode when ripe and will disperse their contents across the garden. Bloom time of year is late spring, early summer, midsummer, late summer, early fall, and mid-fall. Sun requirements are sun to partial shade. Now from the Triangle Gardener magazine, Controlling Japanese Beetles by Helen Yost. When summer arrives in the Triangle area, so do the Japanese beetles. While we, hopefully, are ready to battle the heat and humidity in July and August spring, we're never prepared for the Japanese beetle, or at least I'm not. It didn't used to be this way. The first detected Japanese beetle was found in the U.S. in 1916 in a nursery near Riverton, New Jersey. Today, this beetle can be found in at least 30 states, and just 2 years ago, it showed up in Canada. While so many people come and stay in the Triangle because of our mostly favorable climate, so does the Japanese beetle. Also, because of the availability of a wide variety of host plants and the lack of natural enemies to this beetle from Japan, they thrive here. Although the European starling is the best-known beetle eater, we certainly don't want any more of those either. The Japanese beetle is a widespread and destructive pest of grass, landscape, and ornamental plants, such as roses, crabapple, apple, Japanese maple, crepe myrtle, and pin oak, plus cherry, plum, and peach trees. Adults emerge from the ground and begin feeding on plants in June. Activity is most intense over the 4 to 6 weeks beginning in late June, after which the beetles gradually die off. Individual beetles live about 30 to 45 days. Japanese beetles feed on about 300 species of plants, devouring leaves, flowers, and overripe or wounded fruit. They usually feed in groups, starting at the top of a plant, working downward. Beetles are most active on warm, sunny days in direct sunlight. A single beetle does not eat much. It is group feeding by many beetles that results in severe damage. The adults are generally metallic green, with bronze or coppery brown wing covers, leaving part of the abdomen to show. The five patches of white hairs on each side of the abdomen and one pair on the last abdominal segment distinguish Papilio japonica from all other similar-looking beetles. This description: metallic green, coppery brown wings with a bit of the abdomen showing, is reminiscent of the vintage copper-toned suntan ad with a puppy pulling down the bathing suit pants of a surprised brown toddler at the beach. Not so. Egg laying begins after adult beetles emerge from the ground and mate. Then females leave the plants in the afternoon, burrow 2 to 3 inches in the soil, and lay the eggs. Each female can lay a total of 40 to 60 eggs during her lifetime. The next 10 months, Developing beetle lives in soil as a white larva or grub. I'm sure you've seen grubs. White, C-shaped caterpillars are visible in my garden anytime I sink a shovel. Control efforts need to address both adult and larval populations through an approach that integrates the following methods. Make it your morning and late evening ritual to handpick Japanese beetles from your plants if you can reach them. During these hours, beetles are less alert and slow. They can be squeezed to death, very satisfying indeed, or dropped into soapy water. The next approach is for those with patience, which is hard to have when it comes to this destructive pest. You won't get immediate gratification as from above, but perhaps you'll be better off next year. Adding beneficial nematodes to your ground areas kills immature stages. These microscopic, worm-like parasites actively hunt, penetrate, and destroy grubs in the soil. Apply in spring before beetles emerge. You'll have even better results with a 1-2 punch by also adding milky spore, a naturally occurring host-specific bacterium that attacks the destructive white grubs in turf. Even if you use milky spore and beneficial nematodes, you can still have Japanese beetles. Nothing's foolproof. If it were, Japanese beetles wouldn't be a problem. There are natural insecticides, but remember, even beneficial insecticides will kill more than just the pest. Commercially available Japanese beetle traps can be useful, but have been proven to lure more beetles and result in more substantial damage. For your roses, there is a practice called keep them in the green. Cut your colorful roses and bring inside during Japanese beetle season. Sorry, this is not foolproof, but your house will look fantastic. This year, enjoy your summer and make controlling Japanese beetles a hobby, not a vendetta. Bathing suit optional. And now some events coming up. Japanese Maple Grafting Workshop. July 27th, 8:30 a.m. to 12 noon, or 1 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. Participants learn to graft Japanese maples from two experts. Tim and Matt Nichols will discuss and demonstrate grafting techniques and then individually assist each participant as they graft their own plants. Each participant will graft a minimum of 5 Japanese maples. There is a fee and you have to pre-register. This happens at J.C. Ralston Arboretum in Raleigh. For more information, call 919-515-3132. 919-515-3132. 3132, and a hypertufa trough and concrete leaf workshop on July 27th. Make a hypertufa trough 9 a.m. to 12 noon. Concrete leaf workshop 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. There is a fee and you need to pre-register. This also happens at J.C. Ralston Arboretum. For information, call 919-515-3132. 919-515-3132. Nature Adventure Camp. Artists in the Gardens, 6th through 8th grade. This is July 29th through August the 2nd. Use the garden for inspiration and as a source of unusual materials as we explore habitats, uncover wildlife, and identify plants. Experiment with various media, learn new techniques, and collaborate to express yourself. Please see the Nature Adventures Camps page for more info. There is a fee, and you need to pre-register. This will happen at the Sarah P. Duke Gardens in Durham. For more information, call 919-668-1707. 919-668-1707. And from State by State Gardening e-newsletter, here's an event coming up. July 28th in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Moth Magic for Families. North Carolina Botanical Garden. There are thousands of moths in the Carolinas, ranging from minute to gigantic, and marked with beautiful patterns in black, white, and gray, or bright colors, rivaling their day-flying relatives. For National Moth Week, July 20 through 28, the garden is hosting this moth-washing event for children 8 and up with an adult. Learn identification and how to attract nocturnal lepidopterans with natural science educator Mike Dunn. Moths will be attracted with bait and lights, 8:30 to 10:30 p.m. It's $10, members are $9, and registration is required. For more information, call 919-962-0522. 919-962-0522. Now from the Tips for the Lazy Gardener by Linda Tilgner. Tip-top tomatoes. To reduce moisture loss and encourage a strong root system, prune off all but the top rosette and the large leaves just below it. Bury the rest of the stem. If it's leggy, lay it in a trench. The tomato will put out roots all along the stem. One gardener digs a hole or trench deeper than needed, stuffs shredded newspaper in it to help hold moisture, then covers it with soil and places the transplants as usual. Ray Lambert takes some time out to install self-fertilizing tomatoes. First, he digs out an 8 to 12-inch deep circle 4 feet in diameter, fills it with manure and compost, and puts a little soil on top. He plants 6 early determinate tomato plants around the circumference of the circle and slips wire cages over them. In the center of the circle, he sets a 2-foot high, 2-foot diameter cylinder of pea wire. He fills it with manure and compost. In dry weather, he lets a hose trickle into the top of the feeding cylinder. He does virtually nothing else. Doesn't prune, doesn't weed, doesn't feed. The cages contain the plants. The plants are close enough together so they shade the soil and no weeds grow, and the center cylinder does the feeding. He does the same thing with late varieties of tomatoes, but because they need more room, he sets only 4 plants around 1 feeding cylinder. In mid-August, he chops off the tops so all growth goes to ripening tomatoes. Plant borage among the tomatoes to attract bees for early fruit set. If you're a fisherman and sometimes get trash fish, such as suckers, don't throw them back. Pop them into your freezer. Come planting time, think of the Indians at the Plymouth Colony and drop them into the soil. Try placing one in a hole dug for a tomato plant, for example. Put the fish in first, then 3 or 4 inches of soil, then the plant. As an experiment, put a fish under every other tomato plant so that you can measure the results. We have run out of time for today's episode. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So long, until the next time. If you have any comments or questions for us, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. 3